This week on Life and Faith.
There are people that just in the midst of ISIS continued to pray. The monastery that I climbed up at sunset and saw this remarkable scene where these monks were singing in Aramaic, the language of Jesus Christ.
You're a doctor. Would you rather be the dad on the other side of the incubator?
They gave us the Bible and told us to close our eyes and pray. When we opened our eyes, we had the Bible and they had the land.
They felt like this is what they were made for.
Welcome to Life and Faith from CPX. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore. And today we're bringing you an interview that I've been wanting to do for maybe 2 years now. I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, now I'll get you, Natasha, to introduce our distinguished guest for today's program in a moment. But first up, tell me what prompted this conversation in the first place.
So in 2022, I read a book called The Vanishing. The subtitle is The Twilight of Christianity in the Middle East. We often think of countries like Iraq or Syria or Egypt as Muslim countries, which they are, of course, by majority of population. And of course, Israel as well in the Middle East with a majority Jewish population, and don't realize that there are actually in these countries Christian communities that have been there continuously since like the first century or so, and that they may not be there much longer.
Yes. So this book has been called a work of pre-archaeology, meaning what does that mean?
Yeah, I kind of like this phrase. I guess the book excavates these communities, provides a record of who they are, how they've lived and survived in these places for millennia, in what may well be the twilight of their existence. So I guess it's archaeology in advance. These things will be extinct, potentially, tragically, in the near future. And that makes it quite a haunting book, actually. It's sad, but it's also really illuminating, full of just these fascinating snapshots of people's lives and their courage and their connection to these lands.
Right. Now, the author is Janine DiGiovanni, who's, well, it's hard to imagine someone more qualified to write this book.
Yeah. So her credentials are pretty impressive. Janine DiGiovanni is a journalist and a human rights investigator. She's been called one of our generation's finest foreign correspondents. She's covered wars across three continents and won a bunch of awards. And she's gone back again and again to places like Iraq and Gaza. She's really gotten to know people in these communities as they've faced successive, you know, wars and various hardships. Also, she just writes really beautifully. Like, I found this book incredibly moving. It's really stayed with me.
Yeah. Now, these days, Janine is head of a thing called the Reckoning Project, which is a war crimes unit inside Ukraine. We'll be hearing a bit about that at the end of the interview. But Natasha, no wonder she's been a hard person to pin down for an interview.
Yeah, I really appreciate her making the time to speak with me. She spoke to me from Paris. And I started by asking her about the different places that she's worked, the wars and the atrocities that she's covered.
I started working in the West Bank and Gaza during the First Intifada in 1990. And from there, I went to the Balkans and reported the Bosnian War, later on the war in Kosovo, most of the upheaval in that region throughout the 90s. I also worked in Africa extensively in that time. Later, after 9/11, I reported from Afghanistan, Iraq, and then the Arab Spring, all of the Arab countries, as well as the war in Syria for many years. So I think it's around 18 wars and sadly three genocides over 35 years now.
Why is it that you do this job? I mean, most people try to get as far away from war as possible. Why do you go towards it?
I don't think of myself as going towards it, but I do think that this is very much a vocation for me rather than a job. And I am focused on war crimes and crimes against humanity and human rights. So I see it much more as a way of bearing witness to these terrible things that happen that often people like your listeners or readers of my books would not know about otherwise.
You've written a wonderful book that's also quite heartbreaking about the vanishing of Christianity in the Middle East. And you write that often while you're in these places during times of war, you will go to a mass or a church service. And I'm wondering why that's important to you.
Well, you know, it's always extraordinary in the midst of terrible chaos and disorder and the horror of war that sometimes churches are still standing and that people still go to them or flock to them as a place of protection and also where they can reinforce their faith. You know, in some cases, churches were used in terrible ways. During the Rwandan genocide, people sheltered inside churches as a way of thinking that they wouldn't be killed, but in fact, they were killed inside churches in terrible ways with machetes. But, you know, during the siege of Sarajevo, and Sarajevo was and is still a mixed city of Christians, Muslims, Jews, Protestants. It's a multi-ethnic place, or it was even more so before the war. I would go to the cathedral, which was just for me, a place where I could feel peace or try to feel peace and to pray. And it was also very touching to see people gathered there, you know, even though, you know, on Christmas Eve 1992 in Sarajevo, there was a huge risk that the church would get shelled. People went to the midnight service there. And it was really touching because you saw the Catholic soldiers come down from the front line to receive Holy Communion. And they played Silent Night in Serbo-Croat. They sang it. It was incredibly touching, you know, that in the middle of this very dark time where evil things were happening, that people turned to their faith as a way of reassurance and love, I think. Yeah, love.
Tell me, who are the Christians of the Middle East? How old are these communities?
They are ancient. You know, they go back thousands and thousands of years. The Assyrians, the Chaldeans, the Eastern Orthodox, which are divided up into many different branches. They have been there from, you know, time immemorial, from the time of the prophets walking from the Holy Land, from Palestine, on foot or with donkey or horses to get to Iraq, the Nineveh Plain, Syria, Egypt, the great monasteries of Egypt. So these places have survived, you know, centuries. They've survived plagues, they've survived pillages, they've survived raids, they've survived purges, and, you know, they most recently survived the Islamic State, ISIS.
Have they survived? I mean, these different communities are facing different kinds of impossible situations, right? You think we might be looking at the end of Christian communities in the region?
I think it's a really dire situation. You know, I think there are people that are hanging on, and each country is different. So Egypt is very different. The Copt community are deeply embedded within the Egyptian society, and same with Lebanon, which I did not include in my book, The Vanishing, because Lebanon is a completely different situation. You know, the Christians there are part of the constitutional process, and, you know, they are very deeply established. But in Iraq and Syria, and indeed Gaza, these are communities that need to be protected to help them thrive because they're deeply in danger.
A few numbers for you here from Janine's book, The Vanishing. In Iraq, Christians have been present since the time of reportedly Thomas the Apostle in the first century. Before the war, there were nearly 1.4 million Christians. At the time of the book's release in 2021, that was down to an estimated 250,000. In Syria before the war, there were about 1.1 million Christians out of a population of 22 million. By 2015, maybe 700,000 of those 1.1 million had fled. Gaza, if we go way back to the 4th century, it was entirely Christian. Now the Christian community there is hanging by a thread.
The Gaza Christian minority at the time that I was writing the book was about 1,000 people in a population of more than 2 million. They'd been in decline for decades. they, you know, as the war rages, they really are worried about their survival because they're caught in the crossfire between Israeli soldiers. In one case, one woman, Elhan, who I had met, who was the organist at the church, was shot by Israeli soldiers. And then, terrible story, you know, someone told me that the tanks rolled over her and she lay in agony. She was an elderly woman, and she died. The Holy Family Catholic Church, where I had spent a lot of time researching my book, two Palestinian Christians were killed. You know, it's just, it's an incredible tragedy. All of Gaza. What I don't want to do right now is just say the Christian lives are worth more than the other lives, because they're not. They're absolutely, you know, it's a horrific situation. It's absolutely tragic. But, you know, getting back to the Christians in Gaza, Gaza was a Bible stop for Jesus, Mary, and Joseph on their way to and from Egypt. So really, really extraordinary story of their survival. And it's just absolutely tragic now.
You talk about Egypt there as kind of a counterpoint where certainly the Christians in Egypt, a very ancient community, are under a lot of pressure, but it's a very different kind of pressure to somewhere like Iraq or like Gaza. I was really struck by a conversation that you recount in the book with a businessman in Cairo who told you that, you know, for this community, for the Copts to fall down, it means all of Egypt will have to fall. Christians are a part of Egypt as ancient as the country. I'm wondering if these communities do vanish from places in the Middle East, what effect does that have on the region?
I mean, I think we have to look at it in a much more historical way. It would be tragic for these communities to disappear. But in terms of the geopolitics of it, you know, they're part of the fabric of society. So first of all, I don't think Egypt is a good example because I don't think it will ever happen there. So, I mean, I think you look more at Iraq, which is more in danger, or Syria. You know, Christians in Iraq showed tremendous courage in the face of the Islamic State. You know, they were given choices of either paying a tax or of converting. Some of them actually stayed in Mosul, in the city of Mosul, during the occupation by ISIS. So rather remarkable. Others lost everything. You know, they lost their farms. They lost their businesses. They lost some villages I went to in the Nineveh Plain were empty of people, you know, and they were rebuilding the churches. And you walk through these churches, which had been decimated, and you just would feel that the hatred of destroying the icons and the statues, you know, this is cultural genocide. It's similar to bombing mosques, you know, with the bombing the mosques in Gaza or bombing during the Bosnian War. Bosnian Serbs bombed mosques in northwest Bosnia. You know, when you do that and you eradicate people's symbols of their faith, it's a very profound statement. So, you know, it's something that the message of Christians in the Middle East has really fallen off the agenda because there's so many other things happening in the world right now. So, you know, but I think it is really important that we remember what happens to these people. And what I tried to do with the vanishing, what I try to do when I write in general is give the bigger picture by focusing on individual stories. And I think in a way that brings the story back to all of us. And there are stories of people who felt at times their faith was being tested. There are people who feared for their lives because of their faith. And then there are people that just in the midst of ISIS continued to pray. The monastery that I climbed up at sunset and saw this remarkable scene where these monks were singing in Aramaic, the language of Jesus Christ. So, you know, if you hear that language and you realize how ancient this faith is and how extraordinary the roots of Christianity are, how deep they are and how far back it goes and people remain rooted in their faith. I found that so moving, so incredibly moving.
One of the wonderful things about Janine's book is the picture it sketches of what life was like for people in these places before war came. If we only know countries like Syria and Iraq through the news, we think of them as war-torn by default. Janine writes of people's deep connection to the land and how intrinsic a part of their faith that is. For many Westerners who can be a bit more rootless and individualistic, it's hard for us to grasp what's at stake for these communities as they decide whether to stay or to go in the face of terrible danger and hardship. I asked Janine, why do people stay?
It is their home. Because, you know, emigrating would kill Christians in the Middle East. It would kill the Iraqi Christians. It would kill their, you know, they have a strong desire to maintain this long line of faith. You know, they're embedded in the country. Their imprint is profound. So if they leave, if they go to Canada or Australia or the US, which many of them do and did, they would disappear. They would disappear from Iraq and Syria. You know, despite the persecution, they play such a vital role. And there is one other thing. Middle Eastern Christians are usually, and I don't want to make stereotypes, wealthy, well-educated, and politically moderate, so to speak. So they had a very active role in the social, economic, political, as well as the sport spheres of their society. They made significant contributions to Arab and Islamic civilization since the introduction of Islam. And they've had, you know, significant impact contributing to culture in Turkey, Iran, throughout the region. So leaving, I mean, I think they would answer your question and say, why should we leave? The first thing that happens when invading armies come is people want to flee, right? They want to protect themselves. Think of the Gazans now huddled in Rafah. Imagine their terror. They want to pick up and go to Egypt, where they would have to pay huge amounts of money to cross the border, by the way. But why should they? It is their land. It is their country. And if they leave, they depopulate, which is exactly what the Israeli government wants. Or it would be exactly what ISIS pre-2016 wanted. They wanted the Christians to flee. So instead, they kind of remain defiantly relying on their faith to protect them.
This is Life and Faith, and Natasha is speaking with the war correspondent and human rights investigator Janine DiGiovanni about what she's witnessed of Christians and Christianity in the Middle East and the impact that's had on her.
How would you, after everything that you've seen and experienced, how would you describe your own relationship to faith?
You know, I was brought up Roman Catholic, and it was a huge part of my upbringing. I went to Catholic schools. I went to a convent school, and I believe in God, you know, very firmly. I am not a radical Christian. I believe in abortion. I believe in gay marriage. I've been divorced, so I guess by standards of the Vatican, I'm not a very good Catholic, but faith to me is about compassion and goodness for your fellow man. And it's also about leaving the world a better place than when you started. So I believe that the work I do has had a contribution to society and to mankind. And that keeps me going in many ways. That is my faith. My work is my faith. But of course, you know, the fundamental question that I've asked myself, and I've gone to many theologians, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, throughout my long career, saying, how can God, who is all-knowing and all-compassionate, allow the suffering, the profound suffering of, for instance, children? You know, there are now 19,000 orphans in Gaza. There are people screaming in pain in the few hospitals that the Israeli army has not destroyed, and they don't have medication, and doctors have to listen to them scream for hours. Can you imagine being a doctor? You're supposed to heal people and being unable to heal them because there is no medication because the Israelis are blocking it getting in. So I would say, like, God, are you watching this? How can you allow this to happen? How can you allow such cruelty? So I don't have an answer for that. I cannot. If you ask me now, well, why? I can't. It's something I grapple with.
So from what you've seen and experienced, is faith strong enough to withstand war?
That's a very individual question. You know, I think it would be down to each individual person, how they cling to their faith, how they keep going. I can only answer for myself or the people that I've interviewed who, I don't know many people who actually, strangely enough, as things get harder and things get darker, people seem to cling to their faith more. So I think that that is a really a question that is both mysterious and beautiful at the same time. I think people's faith is a very unique and individual thing, how it is rooted, how people cling to it. And, you know, I've also had the argument on the other side from my friends who are non-believers and say, well, this is a delusion. You know, it's a way of alleviating the terrible pain people are going through. But I've seen, you know, people's faith get them through terrible wars in Africa. You know, there's huge Christian populations in places like the Ivory Coast or Nigeria, where I've seen people who were locked in churches and churches burned, and the survivors still are strong believers. So, you know, there are many factors going against Christians in the Middle East. Emigration, you know, people that flee to the diaspora. There is wars throughout Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Egypt, rise of, you know, General Sisi. It's not, life under him is not easy. And yet they continue, and yet their faith is still strong. So I think we need to really support these people, know more about them, know more about what they're doing, and salute their extraordinary courage, really extraordinary courage.
Can I ask for you personally, you've seen quite a number of wars in the lead up, in the thick of it, in the aftermath, so many kind of armies come and go. Does that kind of give you a long view of these things, like a sense of this too shall pass? Or does it kind of make you despair that there's always another conflict, there's always another breakdown coming?
There will always be war. It is part of man's nature. I mean, there's been war from the beginning of time to our current wars raging throughout the world. And by the way, there are many wars that don't get focused, you know, are not on the front pages of the Sydney Morning Herald or the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. There are wars that are ongoing in countries for years and years, and people suffer quietly. And in many cases, their faith is the thing that allows them to survive. I think, you know, going back to the Christians persecuted by the Islamic State, it was systematic mass murder in Iraq, Syria, Egypt, and parts of Libya. And it really climaxed during the Syrian civil war and later by the spillover from that war. In 2016, I think, the European Union recognized the persecution of these religious Christians by the Islamic State as genocide. And it was a unanimous vote. And the U.S. House of Representatives also followed suit on that, you know, saying that the atrocities against these people were genocide. The British Parliament also denounce the actions against minorities. Genocide is a very strong indictment. You know, in Ukraine, we're looking at genocide because of the deportation of the Ukrainian children by Russian forces. It's something my project, the Reckoning Project, are looking at very closely. And in the aftermath of ISIS, I spent a lot of time in Iraq. The Yazidi people who are not Christians endured what we are now looking at as a genocide as well. So long term, what I want to emphasize here is the trauma, right? So you don't undergo your people who came so close to extinction and not suffer from that. So in long term, I think we always have to look at trauma. We always have to look at transitional justice. The crimes of ISIS are being investigated, but justice delayed is justice denied. It's been nearly 10 years. It's 10 years in June, actually, that ISIS rolled into Mosul, June 10th, 2014. A decade. And in the meantime, people try to continue to live their lives. You know, that kind of trauma of Assyrian Christians living in Mosul who were either forced to convert to pay the jizya, you know, the taxes, or face execution. How do you stop having nightmares about that? They were ordered to leave the borders of the Islamic Caliphate within a deadline. And, you know, the rows of cars that stretched out from Mosul then with people trying to get to the villages and Nineveh Plain and then being pushed out there was just something that won't go unforgotten. You know, ISIL captured Karakesh, Tel Kepi, Bartella, Karamish. These were all villages like that were in a string along the Nineveh Plain. And, you know, those churches have been rebuilt and people are returning, but many won't. You know, they're now in Australia or they're now in Canada or they're now in the U.S. or elsewhere. And, you know, there's still crimes. You know, gunmen still kill Christian cops in Egypt. In Syria, you know, the war is still ongoing. You know, we don't hear much about it, but it is. So we have to keep awareness going. And I think that's really important for your listeners to keep on it, you know.
I couldn't let Janine go without asking her to explain a bit about the work that she's doing currently with the Reckoning Project.
I am the executive director of the Reckoning Project. We're a small war crimes unit inside Ukraine. We were founded in 2022, a few days after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the full-scale invasion. We gathered testimonies from witnesses throughout the country of the atrocities, and we use these testimonies for two things. One is to build legal cases. We help prosecutors in various international justice mechanisms, but we also use them for media content. So to kind of fight false news coming out of the Kremlin and misinformation, we use factual evidence to write articles which can then explain the truthful narrative. This year, we're working very closely on the stolen Ukrainian children, the 19,000 kids that have been taken to, 16,000 kids, probably more, some people say up to 30,000, that have been taken to Russia and forcibly adopted. So we're working on that. And we are working on indoctrination. We're working on torture. We're working on deportation and also indiscriminate attacks on civilians in Kherson, in Kharkiv, in Zaporizhia, in Chernihiv, and many other places. I'm very proud of my team. The researchers are all Ukrainian, and they're all working for justice in Ukraine. So for me, after witnessing so many atrocities and so many wars and so many genocides, to see, you know, us working towards justice in Ukraine is incredibly, gives me faith, and gives me hope.
One of the many strengths of Janine's book, The Vanishing, is the way that it tells the story of whole communities or their histories through encounters with the lives of individuals there now. I asked Janine if there was someone in particular she had met in Ukraine who she could tell us about.
There are so many. I think in the aftermath of Bucha in April 2022, which Bucha is a kind of suburb which was overrun by Russian soldiers and horrific atrocities happened. You know, I think just one small story, sitting with a mother outside, she was trying to repair her little shack where she lived, which had been destroyed, and her son had been killed, tortured, brutally tortured, and she showed me photographs of his torture. I really don't want to talk about it on air. It was horrific. And, you know, I'm a mother, and you immediately identify and think, what if that was my son? You know, the pain that this woman felt, and she was weeping. And some village kids had come to help her put her house back together. And I remember sitting outside with her. It was a sunny day, very cold, and just thinking about how people put their lives back together after war, how difficult it is. So I think the Ukrainian people are tremendously proud and determined to win back their territorial integrity. They have been brutalized and they have been traumatized. It's been an honor to work on the Reckoning Project and to lead my team. It's been an honor to work 35 years in all these war zones with these extraordinary people. I feel very privileged and lucky every day of my life that I do this work because, you know, I have a purposeful life. And it gives me a lot of pride, but, you know, it is my faith that has enabled me to do this.
This has been Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart, and Natasha Moore. Our thanks today to Janine Giovanni for sharing about her work. Her book, which is one of many she's written, is called The Vanishing, The Twilight of Christianity in the Middle East. And Natasha strongly recommends it.
Yes, I do.
And you can find out more about her war crimes work in Ukraine at thereckoningproject.com.
As always, we would love for you to share this episode with someone you think would enjoy it, would benefit from it. Do send us an email. That address is podcast@publicchristianity.org. We'd also love for you to sign up for our CPX newsletter so you can find out about all the other things we do as well. That link is in our show notes.
And before we go, thanks as always to our producer, the courageous Alan Douthwaite. Next week.
I worked before Taliban taking over and during and after Taliban taking over. Sometimes we couldn't really visit all the places because it was highly dangerous to go to places which were occupied by the Taliban. But we took a bold stand of reaching out to the places. So we said we will stand by the people, and people felt that we were with them during the most crucial moments.